The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to a genuine rock and roll legend, Graham Parker. No shit, Graham Parker. Stick around, because this interview is more than a rumor. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of guys who may have sold more records and earned higher paydays for their concerts, but who would trade it all for an ounce of the credibility and integrity of Graham Parker in the new-to-media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Graham Parker. Graham friggin' Parker. Where the hell has that guy been? If you made a list of artists whose rock and roll personified the sound of the mid to late 70s, I think Graham Parker and The Rumor would have to be near the top. The top, that is, of the list of people who actually heard the man and his band. He was the guy that the major rock critics of the time insisted you had to know, frankly, whether you liked it or not. I think one of the things that may have hurt Graham and The Rumor was that the people who loved them demanded that we all love them too. Which was, you know, may have been a kind of a turnoff for some people. It also probably didn't help that Parker's reputation with a portion of the press was as a distant, difficult chap who might have been a little difficult to get to know and get close to. Now, the high water mark for Parker was the release of the album Squeezing Out Sparks. More than one reviewer described it as the perfect rock and roll album. And a whole lot has happened since Parker broke off from The Rumor in 1980 after a five-year run. In the decades since, he's been mostly a solo act, sometimes touring backed by a band called The Figs, and reinventing himself more than once for practical reasons. The latest reinvention is as the willing subject of a Kickstarter-supported documentary film called Don't Ask Me Questions, The Unsung Life of Graham Parker and The Rumor. Produced and directed by Michael Gramiglia, it not only brings Parker back together with The Rumor to record a new album, it also, at long last, offers the public a glimpse of a man in full, musician, dad, nature lover. Parker and his friends and admirers, including Bruce Springsteen, Joe Jackson, Nick Lowe, DJ Meg Griffin, filmmaker Judd Apatow, Paul Rudd, and others, help us understand a man who had no real preparation for a life in the spotlight and may wish, in retrospect, that he had handled his early opportunities, a little differently. And with that, Graham Parker, welcome to Mr. Media.
How are you doing, Bob? Thank you.
I'm good. Good to see you. Delighted you could do this with us. Graham, there's a guy early in this documentary, which is a fascinating portrait. I believe his name is Nigel Grange. He was an A&R guy for Phonogram Records. And he gives us this, what I thought was great insight into a young Graham Parker. He says he was a gas station attendant, a guy off the street, out of his depth. He was very uneasy. Now, do you recognize the chap that's being described by him?
Yeah, at that point in time, I'd sort of communicated by grunting, I think. I don't really think that I was very outgoing. I was just, I think I was just driven my songwriting had got to this point where I knew that things were going to happen. And I was probably a bit arrogant and driven and concerned only with that. And if people didn't understand it, well, tough luck, you know. So I really didn't have a lot to say to him. I remember that meeting, strangely enough, because some of the early parts of your career are obviously very sort of important because it's the first time this has happened. You're talking with an A&R guy from a major record label. And I didn't really – I can't you know, I didn't have much to say, really. It was like, you heard the music, you want to sign me to a deal, what have I got to talk about? So I think that was probably, you know, I was 24, I think, just around that age then. And so it was, you know, I just wasn't very communicative. But thankfully, he didn't care and gave me a record deal anyway.
Well, I wondered, is it the kind of thing where you might have come off with him, and maybe other people early on, it might have come off as arrogance, but also if you're not prepared for certain situations in business or social, I mean, sometimes we say less because we just don't know what to say, and it's just not a situation that we're comfortable with.
Well, yeah, also my manager was there, Dave Robinson, who basically discovered me, as it were, and became my manager. So, you know, he's an Irish guy. I'll let him do the talking.
Okay, so that was what it was.
Basically, yeah.
All right. Well, and the other interesting thing early on in the documentary that we learned about you is from your own description. I think when you're in school, you were dealing with this employment officer. I don't know how else to describe him. I'm guessing you might have been in high school or about.
Yeah, the youth employment officer, and I would have been about 15. I think we left school at 16 in those days in a poor lower class education. Yeah, that was an interesting meeting with him.
And you had filled out information about yourself, and you had been very earnest in it. And I think this will surprise some people. One of the things you described in there is that you said that you sort of wanted to be the next David Attenborough. You wanted to work with animals and you know, be in the great outdoors. And if you would, this is not giving away anything, I think, can you share a little bit about what the response was from this fella?
Well, yeah, I guess I was naive enough to not realize that David Attenborough was actually educated, you know, unlike me. And so he was you just couldn't become, you know, somebody like David Attenborough without an education. But that's what I wrote down. We all had this questionnaire from the youth employment officer. And so I filled, you know, what do you want to do? And I filled out this nonsense about going to exotic countries and capturing animals for zoos, you know, like David Attenborough. And he said, I think you'd be good working in a supermarket. He just really, that's all he said about it. And I said, no, I wouldn't. I don't think I'd be good at that at all. I don't want to do that. And that was it. That was the end of it. He just sort of sighed and said, okay, think about it. Yeah. But, you know, the thing with me is I grew up in the country. I was born in London, but I grew up in the Surrey Delta, as we blues men like to call it, the Camberley Delta, the suburban delta of blues. And we all grew up, all the kids sort of could identify various species of birds. And, you know, there were canals and lakes and things. We go fishing. And it was a very sort of nature-oriented existence, really, because I could walk out of my parents' house and I'd be in the woods, and that'd be it. As I say in the documentary, that was pretty much a big part of my growing up. And the other part was you know, as soon as you got to be 15 or 16, going to see bands whenever you could, if they'd let you in, you know, and things like that. So there was a kind of a dichotomy going on there. But that background of being fascinated with nature, which I am to this day. I still watch all the nature shows I can on the TV, and so does Martin. Actually, my guitarist Martin here. He's a, you know, very into. It's one of those things. I don't see how you can't be. And I find people who aren't. I mean, in upstate New York, for instance, I've been out, you know, playing soccer with guys, and a turkey vulture flies over, and somebody says, "Look at the size of that bird," and it's someone who grew up there. And it's like, what is that? And I'm like, you, how do you not know what that is? There's thousands of them. They just don't know. I find that absolutely impenetrable that people do not know the natural world to some extent and relate to it and are fascinated. They're just not. And it's very interesting, that, because I remember reading this book, a bit of a horrible title, Red Tails in Love, about red tail hawks living in New York City on, you know, opposite Woody Allen, who really got to like them because they scared the pigeons off. you know, they were crapping everywhere. And so he was a big supporter. But there were all these people lined up. There was a film made about this book and about these red-tailed hawks nesting on a building in the center of New York City. And there's, you know, a group of people in Central Park every day with the big cameras and the huge lenses watching the birds. And there's some guy talking on this little documentary about this, saying, yeah, I'd look at these people and think, what losers. What a lot of losers, you know. And then somebody said to him, as he's looking at them, trying to figure out why they're doing this stupid thing, they say, yeah, do you want to have a look? Have a look through the lens. And he looked and saw the red-tailed hawks on the building. And he said, I was hooked instantly. I mean, his whole worldview changed by seeing this magnificent bird. And, you know, that but his attitude before that was probably typical of a lot of people. Hmm. You know, people, somebody interested in lizards, snakes. That's funny, isn't it? That's weird. They think you're weird. I don't get it. You know, it's like, you know, all these things are the jewels of the earth to me, not gold and silver and all that rubbish, you know. Well, I think the creatures are.
I think if people, when they see the documentary, some of the most interesting moments, I mean, yeah, it's great. There's Bruce Springsteen. There's, you know, there's Joe Jackson. That's great. But some of the most interesting moments on the film were you out in the woods. At one point, you open your hand and a bird flies off. You've got a snake at one point. You've got other things. And it's I looked at that and I went, yeah, you know, I mean, it's years later, but I could see you hosting one of those shows on one of the nature channels or National Geographic. I mean, who wouldn't be drawn to that? You seem to have this real affinity, mm-hmm. not just that you like to watch them, but I mean, you're handling these things and perfectly comfortable. It didn't look like anything was squirming to get away from you. We're not talking dogs or cats here. We're talking about nature.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's still always there with me, and it's strange to have a life in rock and roll, which is sort of the opposite of that.
Nature.
You know, yeah, it is. It's, well, there's a lot of animals. I'm not, you know, maybe there are animals, but they're dressed up in clothing, you know. Most of them wear suits and work for record companies. But it's there's that dichotomy, but you get on the tour bus and you're in hotels and you're, you know, performing in front of lots of people. And it's a very, very different world. But I would still, you know, when there's a day off, I'd still maybe wander off and look around and remember that that's really what I prefer to be doing, probably. But, you know, yeah, that's just always been with me. And I'm glad they brought it up in the documentary. It was a good thing that they kind of picked up on that because a lot of people think that we just sit around in pubs getting drunk and then we play guitars and it's not true really.
I mean, sit around in pubs getting drunk playing guitars. I didn't realize they were separate.
Well, but they. I guess we used to do that when we had to play in pubs and that was all that they gave you to play. But once we didn't have to play in pubs, we never wanted to do it again.
Now, is there some, I don't know if dichotomy is the word here, but you at one point wanted to make documentaries like a David Attenborough. Here you are the subject of a documentary being studied like some wild animal. Did you find that odd or were you comfortable with that?
Well, the story behind it really is those guys, the Grimalia brothers, John and Michael, they came to me at a gig, and I still remember, you know, there's a lot of blanks in the memory about gigs. Obviously, there's been thousands, and there's a lot of blanks in all kinds of parts of my memory about various things that may or may not have happened. But there's that one gig was in 1998. And it was one of those gigs, a sort of pop-up gig that then disappeared again. It was in the Long Island Brewing Company, in Long Island, of course. It was a packed-out gig. It was great. And I may remember it also because of the – talking of legendary, Elliot Murphy was opening for me, if you know that name.
I know of him. I know the name. I don't know his work.
I think his first album was Aqua Show, and I think it was one of those things in Rolling Stone. It was like, is this the new Dylan? You know, it was one of those things. He got quite a lot of cred. I think he was opening, and the Grimalias approached me there. This was way back in 1998 about making a documentary, and they said, we've done one. It wasn't out then, called The End of the Century, about the Ramones. And I just looked at them really and thought, you know, well, that's a story. I mean, that's got to be almost Shakespearean, isn't it? The Ramones. I said, I'm really not interesting. Don't, you're wasting your time. I just don't think it'll fly. I said, I don't see it really. So it was an odd, it was a strange idea to me. And then a couple of years later, I released some short stories on St. Martin's Press, called Carp Fishing on Valium, which came out a collection of short stories. And it did all right. It was in hardcover and then it was in paperback. And I did a tour to support that, where I would read from a story and sing a song that I'd written to go with the stories. There's one story called Me and the Stones. It's where the narrator, Brian Porker, Mick Jagger is dead. He's been run over by a bus in London. And they need someone to replace him. Keith wants to replace him and keep the Stones rolling, as it were. So Brian gets an audition. And I wrote a song for that called Custom Fanny. And it's from the Stones' latest album, Cloven Hoof. You know, so I was out there doing this tour, which some people came up to me and said, that's the best show I've ever seen. And others were shouting, more songs. Why are you doing this? And I was like reaching for my wallet saying, here's 20 bucks. I'm sorry. It's, you know, the tour is billed as a book tour. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. So don't expect me to do White Honey. Okay. And other people just sort of went through it and thought it was tiresome. And some people loved it, but it was kind of fun. And so that's when I called up the Grimaglia brothers and said, you know what? I'm doing a book tour. Why don't you film that and make a documentary about that? That's it. Nothing else. Hmm. It's much more interesting than my career. This is weird. And so, of course, they did. And then the door was open. So that was it, really. I couldn't stop them then. Hmm. They kept gathering footage over all those years. And the film was essentially finished in about 2010. There was a screening and everything in New York. And then they thought it was finished. I thought it was finished. And then without, you know, on a whim, I reformed the Rumour to do an album. And then a week later, Judd Apatow called me and said, can we meet? And he had this proposal, this idea about me being a character, playing myself in a movie. And of course, I jumped at that. So I'm your man. Hello, you know. And so I called up the Grimaglia brothers and said, the documentary's not finished. I've done a very silly thing. I've reformed the Rumour. And they were like, oh, they'd been dying for this. It had been their dream, of course. You know, and I said, no, it's never going to happen. And I said, also, I think I might be in this Judd Apatow movie. And they were like, oh, drool, you know. I said, I don't know. That could fall through. You don't know movies. Who knows with movies? But he seems pretty keen. And then he sent me the script, and I'm really in this thing. You know, you can end up on the cutting room floor. You don't know. But so they even came to L.A. and filmed, you know, some of the goings on as we were making the movie, as you saw in the documentary.
Right.
And so this whole new scope suddenly appeared in front of us, which is very, very satisfying for those guys. And voila, that's it. That's how we got the documentary done. And it was a serious item, you know.
Well, we should say that the movie is This Is 40, and you do play yourself, and the band performs. You've been the subject of countless, let's say hundreds, thousands of newspaper and magazine profiles, reviews, interviews over the years. Was it easier or harder to be the subject of a documentary than it was to just do a magazine piece, even like a Rolling Stone piece or New York Times? Or?
Well, it's kind of difficult because when you're on camera, you're sort of on. You know, but a documentary calls for some normality and honesty about what you are. Mm-hmm. It calls for that unless you want to continue playing a game about being a mysterious rock and roller. If you want to continue to play that game, I guess you can, but that doesn't seem to be right to me when it's a documentary about yourself. You should reveal something here, which I did about my love of nature and all that kind of stuff. So, and it was done over such a long period of time. It kind of heated up in the last few years because they suddenly had to pack in a lot more, and they got those people to do interviews and all this stuff, as you mentioned earlier. So it was, you know, it was pretty. It was okay. It wasn't really a painful thing. I mean, they had the hard work to do, the editing. really.
So they, I mean, I imagine, now I make my living doing books, nonfiction. I work with people, help them tell their story. And one of the things that happens there, and I imagine it's similar in a documentary, is that because you don't do it in a day or a week, you develop a certain rapport. There's hopefully there's trust that develops between you and the Grimalia brothers. And it's comfortable. It's almost like family, or like a band, I guess, in some ways, that you know each other. And so when they show up with their cameras, you're not like, you know, okay, it's like, I know you guys.
Yeah, it was pretty much like that. You also are aware that they have their own objectives. And sometimes there were things that they had in it that I thought, that's just wrong. You know, you've taken the wrong angle on this. And they looked at it and said, yeah, you're right. It's not, you know, it might be just some certain sentence that they actually cut and it seemed out of context to me, or, you know, they do a bit of that. It's like an interview where you do an hour interview and the headline is part of a sentence that you've said. And it just gives, it's totally wrong to do that. But press do that. It happens, you know. And so they let me be involved enough to make sure that that kind of thing didn't happen. I mean, that's not to say I don't look at myself in it and think, ugh, what, you know, this, but it's not for me. It's for people. It's for viewers. So I'm not going to take it and cosmeticize the whole thing. I was involved in it to quite a degree, but I let them have the final say. And when they edited it, I said, that's very good. That's a compelling, interesting film. Hmm. And it stopped being about me in a way. It was about something else. You know, it was a story. So even I thought, this is very good. I sort of took myself out of the equation a bit and just was watching someone's life and all the people around him as well. You know, the band members talking. Andrew was a librarian. Andrew, the bass player in Yorkshire, and Martin showing him teaching a kid playing guitar. And Bob playing in New Orleans. It was a much bigger story, really, than just rocker, 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 you know.
It was nice later in the film that each of the members of the band gets a little moment where we get to see them, what they're doing. They talk a little about themselves, about the band, talk a little about themselves beyond the band, get us a little caught up. It was very nice that way. So you did have some ability to pull them back from some things and maybe redirect them at point.
Yeah, but very, very, very few things. There were very few things. There might have been something like, you know, I say, can you, you know, just shorten that bit, or something like that, or what I'm talking about here is just doesn't really make sense, or it's not really the impression I'd like to give. Because you say things in interviews, and I mean, most that I read, I usually regret. That sometimes has something to do with the way they've edited it as well. So it's a kind of balance that you're looking for. Well, but there was very little that I had to say about it other than that's really good.
Just by the way, you should know, this will not be edited. This will be whatever it is.
Right, so all the foolishness is real.
It's all real. Another thing that I really liked about the documentary was when I talked about, you know, it was nice to see Graham Parker in nature. We also get to see you as a family man, as a dad. Your beautiful daughter is, at the time, I guess, was in the Peace Corps. Is she still in the Peace Corps?
No, she's now 29, strangely enough, and is in New Zealand, actually, working in New Zealand, and has just been traveling through every single country to get to New Zealand. Hmm. Yeah, she's definitely not settled and doesn't really appear to look like she is. My son, I think he's briefly in there at the end when they play the song Snow Gun at the end, and you see a bit of him. We're sort of monkeying around outside in the snow, and he's like 18, about to go into college. Mm. They got a bit of that in there. That it was Natalie agreed to do an interview. She was more than up for it.
She did great. I mean, she did really well. And what comes across, it's again, this is what I was talking about, getting this picture of a man in full as opposed to, you know, whatever happened in the 30 minutes you sat and talked to the reporter from the Des Moines Register. We see that your daughter, both your kids are in there, but your daughter particularly is interviewed. There's a tremendous amount of love she has for you. You talk about how hard it was to, you know, see her grow up and be a part and just – I also, it was very interesting, though, that she had her own angle on, you know, in the introduction I talk about how, you know, you and the press over the years had kind of a wonky relationship. She talks about how she always wanted to share you with her friends and people who would come over, but that you were always on when you're on stage, and when it came to being home, you didn't want to be on. You didn't want to be entertaining. So she never had that opportunity. And I thought, well, this is probably some of the same Graham Parker that the press felt that they got to know. That was just a little when he's off stage. That's it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. She, I remember. She. I think she's. Yeah. I did try to. I like to avoid company. I think it's – I love being with my daughter, and, you know, as she said, we had that great relationship, and it was all very much based on nature and all kinds of creative stuff like that. But, yeah, sometimes I would say, okay, I'm going out now. Maybe sometime and wander off to the North Pole or something. I do remember when she was just hitting the teenage years, there were a group of girls came for a sleepover. And it was just so it was I was there. I just probably didn't interact because it's weird, isn't it? You know, why would you want to interact with a bunch of girls? I remember one of them saying, oh, I love Clarins. And she's about 12. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't be in this room.
Yeah, I'm the owner of a 17 and a half year old daughter right now. And yeah, I mean, it's like they take over the house. You just want to go run and hide. It's
basically
you don't really want to be involved in that. Love the kid, but yeah, I don't think so. Yeah. So I have a friend, Dean Hendricks, who's a musician here in Florida. And I asked him if he had any questions for you. So I wanted to include something. He was asking about how you felt to be championed by Judd Apatow in This Is 40, and how you felt about it when it was done.
I thought it was astonishing, really, because I saw a screening in New York, one of those things where they invite some people in and press, and I went to see it thinking, well, I did quite a lot of work, and Judd likes lots and lots of takes of everything. So you have no idea what will end up in the film. If anything, I thought probably what I did would be pared down to nothing, but it wasn't. I was astonished and very, very, thrilled by it. And, I think the most shocking thing was watching the credits at the end. My name was as big as Albert Brooks and John Lithgow. I thought, what? He didn't have to do that. But then I thought, well, wait a minute. In my contract, I'm being hired as a principal actor. I wasn't hired as a cameo, you know. So the whole thing astonished me, really. And I think it was about as much fun as you can possibly have working on a movie like that, especially if you're not like Paul Rudd. The amount of lines he has to learn, the amount of workload that someone like that, and Leslie Mann. I mean, Leslie Mann did some dramatic, emotional scenes, and was actually, I think Judd said she's ill. She's ill today. She had to do some really hard stuff yesterday, really tough stuff. You know, for me, it was very challenging because I've never done this before, and Judd wants you to improv. So, you know, you've done the line that's in the script vaguely, which I knew I could improv around. So I brought all this, my own sketches, you know, and when it said that, I had to say, go out to Paul Rudd's character, Pete, and say, yeah, I've got to go to the podiatrist, got a bad foot. It's really hurting. I brought gout into it. You know, I came out with that. Yeah, I've got to go to the podiatrist. And they said, what's wrong? Touchy gout, you know. And I used Chris O'Dowd and Lena Dunham, who were in the back of the scene. I didn't just do it to Paul Rudd's character. I brought them in by looking at them. So I enlarged it. So I sort of got the hang of things. But it's very kind of scary when Judd, he has a producer next to him, Paula Pollini, I think, who works on Saturday Night Live. Very, very witty person. She sits there with some stickers, you know, a notepad thing, those yellow stickers. And as the scene's going on, she's writing jokes and passing them to Judd. And there's like piles and piles by the end of the scene. And so he suddenly shouts out, I was doing a bit with Charlene Yee, which is on the extras on the Blu-ray, mm-hmm. where suddenly Judd shouts out to Charlene, ask Graham if he'll take a piss with you in the closet. And so Charlene Yee suddenly says to me, do you want to come and take a pee in the closet? And I have to react. And I'm glad they had a bit on the Blu-ray, because I reacted in quite a lot of ways, because we did the scene over and over. Uh-huh. And there was a lot where I said, no, which I now know you don't do that in improv, because it kills the scene stone dead. But they put in a very good bit where she said, do you want to take a pee in the closet? And I pause and I go, yeah, all right. and they put that in the Blu-ray. I thought, oh, great, thank you.
That's awesome.
So the whole thing was amazing. And Judd showed incredible belief in me, because I met up with him. And, he told me about the film and thought it might – a character, I might be able to do this. He didn't really know. And I think, you know, that it was also very handy that I said, well, guess what? A week ago, I just reformed the room. And we're going to do an album. And we're going to do it very soon. Be great if they were in it as well. And he sort of laughed. He didn't believe me. And then he called me back a
well,
few
who
days
would believe
later and,
that at the time,
who
right?
would believe that? He called me back a bit later and said, so you're doing an album? When are you doing it? He said, okay, we're going to fly the rumor in for a couple of days. Do filming. Do a bunch of songs. I want cameras in the studio. And I was like, whoa. I mean, that's something that I would normally think, I don't want that. But I said, well, if we, you know, well, how about we can get the Grimalia brothers to film it and share the footage? And he thought about that. Yeah, that's great. Great idea. So they shared all that footage. So that's why on the Blu-ray and DVD, actually, there's like a, on the Blu-ray, there's an 18-minute mini documentary using a lot of that footage. So it was a multimedia thing that we suddenly had. And then they've also released every song that me and the rumor did in those 2 days, which was 12 songs on a DVD called This Is Live.
Oh.
So the whole love kept on going with this thing. So it was a great, great thing.
Well, all right. So speaking of the love, I'll use your term there. You know, a lot of guys, men, women, whatever, reach a certain age where they've produced a lot in their career, but they don't have the kind of outpouring that you're seeing from Judd Apatow or the guys who show up on the documentary, Springsteen. Joe Jackson, I thought, was really interesting. He said, I had to write this down so I'd remember. He said of you, I heard him sing and I thought, if he can do it, so can I. And I thought, you know, a lot of us don't reach a point in our careers where there's people talking about us in this kind of way, or giving us an opportunity to bring Graham Parker and the rumor onto a movie set. How do you feel about that? And certainly, you know, thinking back on the totality of your career at this point.
Well, just taking those specific people and Black Francis, Frank Black was one of them from the Pixies, which are goodness. I know people much younger than me who say, you know him? You know, the Pixies are like God to a lot of
right.
people of a certain age, you know. And I thought they were all very gracious. And Bruce Springsteen said things that I'd never really thought about, things that seemed quite profound, really, to me, about what my music gave people on the surface. And you had to look underneath to find all this richer stuff, the emotion. And he sort of pointed out that a lot of people can't hear the other stuff. They only heard what he described as caustic. That's all they heard. And I've never really been able to analyze it that much and realize, oh, that's – yeah, I suppose most people wouldn't hear what he described as the soul and the beauty of what I've done and what I the way I sing. Because sometimes I hear old stuff back and all I hear is caustic and nasty. And I think it's very unpleasant. But he was pointing out other things, and I thought that was very, very gracious and very, just amazing, really. So I think it's a nice thing to hear that stuff.
Now, as we said, Judd was shocked. The Grimalia brothers were shocked to hear from you. Oh, I decided to get the rumor back together. Was it as easy as saying, "Hey guys, let's get back together and do an album"? I mean, how does Were there politics involved? I mean, I got the sense that you guys didn't end horribly like some bands did. He just pulled the plug and said, you know, it's time to do something else. But it's 30-some years later. How do you bring that back together?
Well, it was very interesting. I emailed people, and most people said, hell yes, let's go. You know, there wasn't too much of a sort of, oh, I don't know whether that's the right thing to do. And I've said this before. I think the 80s would have been totally wrong. The 90s would have been totally wrong. Even the early 2000s would have been the wrong time. To me, it was the perfect time, quite honestly. I don't know why I feel that, but I think it was. I guess when you after I'd done it, I started sort of looking on the internet and things and realized that almost every band in the world had done the same thing, you know. And I was like, no, not very original, is it? but for us, it was no big deal. You know, it was also the documentary pointed something else out to me a bit, because I think both Martin and Steve were saying about when I went to meet with them and said, OK, I want to do something else now. I'm finished with you guys. And I was very blunt and didn't really give my reasons. Again, it's that kind of communication via grunting period still, even in 1979. I really hadn't advanced much. I don't think I started growing up until I was 40. Mm. And even then, because I'm a male, you never really grow up. You know, not quite, do you? Mm. So it was and I realized, God, I that was a shock to people. It wasn't very pleasant. I wasn't very forthcoming. I didn't even really give them reasons. I just said, I want to do something else. But I guess that's what you have to do sometimes a bit. I didn't feel as though I could throw it up for discussion. It was one of those things. I'm often very driven in that sort of way, that once I've got my head wrapped around an idea, I kind of forget everyone else that I might be impacting people. You know, there is that side of me. It's not pleasant, but there again, if you don't do things like that, sometimes you might be swayed. Then you start to double think everything. It was like when I reunited the Rumour this time, I didn't think about it. Hmm. I didn't. There wasn't a thought about it. It was only afterwards I thought, what have I done? This is going to cost me. That was basically it. Hmm. This is going to cost a lot of money. and then I had all these songs and thought, what are these songs? Are they anything like what the Rumour should be doing? I really didn't know. But that's how you sometimes have to deal with stuff. Sometimes you get the idea, you feel that it's right, and you do it. But it does have, you know, there are waves that go out from that, and not everybody takes it as easily as I do. So, you know, there's things you learn along the way.
Which of the guys was most surprised to hear from you, and which of the guys was easiest to pick back up from 30-some years later?
Well, I started out, actually, the idea was to because I've been making a lot of albums using the last couple of albums, Mike Gent from The Figs, who isn't a drummer in The Figs, he's a singer and a guitarist, but his first instrument was drums. Hmm. And he is a seriously tasty drummer. He's got an amazing feel. I mean, really tasty stuff, you know. Absolutely great. So I've been kind of using him to play drums, and then I've been playing the bass and the guitars. And I've been doing a lot of that for years. I mean, Struck by Lightning, I played the guitars. That's going back to 91. I played all the guitar parts, and I've been doing a lot of that for a long time. I thought of getting Andrew on bass and Steve on drums. It popped into my head, I've got to do something different. Maybe I should do a three-piece. And those guys haven't worked together for a long, long time. I've worked with Stephen individually. He played on my album Deep Cut to Nowhere. I've worked with Andrew, who throughout the 80s was on tour with me and played on some records like Struck by Lightning, for instance, and Mona Lisa's Sister, 80s into the 90s. But the two of them together. So and it was Steve who made a joke about, why don't you get Martin, Bob, and Brinsley, and you'd have a proper band. And that's when I did it, and I did not think about it. And nobody was a problem. Everyone agreed this was a very – yeah, of course, let's do it. Very strange. Brinsley, I had to phone him up, and I thought I might get some blowback from Brinsley because you'd just moved out of London to the country. That's, you know, that's sort of a very – a big step. Does that mean he's, and he hasn't played with people for years. He hasn't been playing with bands like Martin, has played with lots and lots of people. And Steve Goulding has as well, the drummer. So I thought Brinsley might be difficult. So I got his phone number from Martin because his internet was down there fixing up this house they're in. And he said, yeah, okay. And then he put the phone down and said to his wife, oh no, he was sort of gray. I think he was the ashen faced Brinsley Schwartz, I think. But there it was. So off we went and did it. You know.
And the movie, the reunion was when? 2010, 2011? That you got the band
we did the album. Martin is in the room. Was it 2010 summer of we recorded the record, or was
it 2011
we recorded the record?
June and July.
Basically, it was July, just around July when we recorded the record. Yeah, it's 2011, and I was after the record going back and forth to LA doing bits on the film, and then the whole band came in. On the last day of August, first day of September, I think. Yeah, then they arrived to do the bit that we did, 2 days of filming.
First class,
Martin shouting. Yes, we're in a universal movie here. First class only for my chaps.
First class, London to Los Angeles.
London to LA, Virgin first class.
Someone like
they'll
that.
They'll never forget it. they'll never do it again.
Well, what's the status of the group now? I mean, have you guys continued to be together? Was it a one-time thing?
We are going into the studio very, very, very shortly and doing another album. I've foolishly done the same thing again. There's more money out the door. Hello. Yeah, we're going to have another go at it. All these things probably have a limited shelf life, or maybe an on and off shelf life. I don't know, but because we seem to be so in demand touring wise as well, that we have a tour coming up in England and Europe in May into June, because the tour we did, we only did four gigs in the UK, and they were packed, and the Shepherd's Bush Empire 2,000 seats sold out months before the gig. And so we've got this sort of demand going here. So I think it's worth squeaking it out for a bit more and having some fun with this. It's just an awesome band to have behind me. And I think they all agree these songs are really something play as well.
How does it feel after all these years to be back together with these guys on stage? The shows are selling incredibly well. People love you. They're showing it. It's got to feel good, right?
Yeah, it's very good. And, I've also developed over many years an interesting solo career, which is another whole level of creativity, playing songs solo. And I'd love to do that. In fact, before the Rumour tour, I went to Japan and played four shows. I did Europe playing solo for a month of gigs. So I've still got that.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the solo. I was thinking about – so you go from – in 80, you cut loose from the band and you basically become a solo act. You're playing guitar. You're singing. You don't have that support behind you. You must have had to change your act, your presentation tremendously. You've got to you could go from, I think, the late 70s where you could probably go up on stage, barely say a word if that was your choice – play the music, let the music speak. But now when it's just you on stage, especially in later years, you've probably got to develop some patter. You've got to tell some stories perhaps, right? Or am I missing?
Absolutely, yeah. No, the whole thing is mostly stand-up comedy sometimes. unless they're not getting the jokes. And it's like, oh, shut up and sing, you know.
Right.
Sometimes they're roaring. And sometimes it's like, that went right over their heads, or I'm just very bad at it. I don't know. I've literally developed a completely different act. And when I started doing solo professionally, because everybody starts perhaps with a guitar, and you might play in a cafe somewhere when you're just before my career began. I did a little bit of that, but I had really very little experience before the Rumour. Really, that was the start of my performing career. I made that album, The Mona Lisa's Sister, and it was a very stripped down album. I wanted to get away from all the 80s bombast and the endless double tracking of guitars and all this stuff. And so I did a stripped down record, and there were four instruments on it, and then we basically stopped. I said, that's it, stop there. This is about the singer and the song. I just wanted to get out of the 80s with those, you know, everything overblown. And the logical step to me after that was, now do something solo, really solo, you know. So I went, I booked a solo tour. My agent found the gigs, and there were a lot of people were willing to do it, to book me. And it was all very stiff. I'd go out there and play songs almost in the arrangement that they were on record. I was overdoing it, and it was they were too fast. And this record, Live Alone in America, came out from that. And a lot of people love it, but I don't really, you know, I don't think it represents what I do now solo, which is much more creative. I do all kinds of things with the songs, and the freedom is brilliant on stage to be able to suddenly think, okay, I don't want to do this bridge again. I'll just go straight to the chorus, or I'm going to expand this, slow it down and tell a joke or something, or describe something about the song and then bang into it. And people love that. And you can change your set list on a dime, you know.
You know what?
Very different thing.
You know what I thought would be interesting? Watching Joe Jackson, whose music I've always loved, it was interesting. I thought, have you two ever toured either with your bands or as solo, you know, just the two of you?
No. I've seen him solo, doubled up with Todd Rundgren, which was very good. Good show. And Joe, there's recordings of this. He used to do my song Can't Be Too Strong in concert, playing it on a piano. Mm-hmm. But we've never – I don't think we've been on the same bill.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah. Make a great pairing, I think.
Yeah.
So I want to squeeze – just before we're running kind of long, but I want to squeeze in my friend Dean's other question for you. It's a very specific music question. He wanted to know, what was it like working with Jack Nitzsche on Squeezing Out Sparks? In what ways did he help shape the work or your approach to that record?
Well, that's discussed in the documentary. I talk about it a bit. I think Steve, the drummer, talks about it a bit, because the first days with Jack Nitzsche were weird, is an understatement, I suppose. He'd come over from America, and he wasn't quite sure what he was doing. He'd heard some very rough demo of mine I'd sent on a cassette of Local Girls and a few bits of other songs, and I guess he was impressed, but he read I was a punk. I don't know what this punk thing is. He was very uncertain about that. And it was only when we started actually getting tracks down, he realized, well, this is a lot more than punk. That's kind of simplistic, isn't it? You know, this is way more complicated than that. The lyrics alone. He got very inspired by it, but at first he didn't know what to do, and he didn't like the way the band were playing at all. He thought they were playing as if they were on stage or something. So he you know, eventually I had to kick him and say, look, we've got to do something. We haven't got anything down on tape in 3 days, you know. So it was very difficult at first. And then he came in, and Martin said he proceeded to drink several Heinekens or something. And he said, right, this is what we've got to do. And it was like, oh, great. He's telling the band what to do. This is really good. And it was very simple stuff. But as Steve Gorling says in the documentary, he told me things that have stuck with me forever. He said, you're playing too much. You're not listening to the song. It's all about you. You know, there's all these cymbals going on. It was all – everyone was sort of competing for space, I think. And that's where Squeezing Out Sparks suddenly turned a different corner into a different area. I think it's a bit of an anomaly amongst my albums now. I think what we do now is much more like Howling Wind. It's complicated music with a very rootsy bass, very, very what you call roots music now, or even Americana, I think. And Squeezing Out Sparks stepped right out of that bag, went somewhere else for one album, and then we did one more album, The Up Escalator, and then that was it. So you can't tell what we would have done if we'd carried on. But, you know, I think Three Chords Good is a continuation from the first album. My aim in the studio was, okay, we've just done Howling Wind, let's do the second one. And that was kind of what I thought. And was, you know, Bob Andrews featured a lot of keyboards, because that album, Howling Wind, I think almost every track had piano and organ. Much of our stuff did. It suits the music to a certain extent. So, you know, we didn't come back and say, what was our greatest album? Well, everyone says Squeezing Out Sparks. We better sound like that then. You know, it's an anomaly, that album. It just kind of sticks out like a sore thumb to me now.
Interesting.
It's weird. Yeah, it is. But that's the way I kind of think about it. But Jack Nietzsche, you know, he did that kind of job for us, I think, that made it a very different thing and made it something that I wanted to make at that time.
Well, Dean, good question. Thank you, Graham. You know, it's interesting to be sitting here talking to you. I think that I was a rock music critic, writer in the 80s, and I never pursued an interview with you because that reputation you had, that kind of, you know, and I just thought, I just don't need that trouble. And I'm sitting here with you now thinking, this was the right time in life for me to talk to you. this has been terrific. I really appreciate your time and your energy. And it's a great documentary. People want to catch up with Graham Parker, find out a little more about the man. This is the thing to do. And folks, you can find Don't Ask Me Questions, The Unsung Life of Graham Parker and the Rumors on DVD or digital download anywhere movies are sold, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching this at MrMedia.com, right below us, somewhere over here, should be the image of Don't Ask Me Questions. You can click on it right now, download it immediately, or Amazon will send a drone to your house and deliver a copy of the DVD. And so I guess what I learned in this conversation too is that This Is Live is also a DVD of your getting back together with the Rumor, and that's available as well.
Yeah, and that's directly from This Is 40. It's filmed in this like 5.1 surround sound and incredible. You know, you imagine a team of camera people and sound people working for Universal in the Judd Apatow movie. So it's us playing 12 songs like Protection and Local Girls, as well as some of the new album. And that's worth looking at as well if you just want to see some us playing, you know. And it's our first performance together in all those years. And there it was on the set of a John Apatow movie.
Wow.
So I recommend both things. And the documentary, thank you for pointing that out to everyone. It's great.
My pleasure. Now, I know that you are a first-generation iPad guy. Can people – are you online with social media at all? Do you have any – do you show up? Do you have a website, Facebook, Twitter, any of that kind of stuff?
Website is grahamparker.net, and it's run by a guy named John Howells.
Okay.
I'm not very hands-on with that kind of stuff. I do Twitter, though. It's Graham Parker, I think it's called, at It's Graham Parker, something like that. Twitter, yeah, look me up on Twitter. It's fun to, you know, post a photograph of some animal that's just been discovered. People are going, what? Why? What's happening with the music? I don't know, but here's a new gerbil that's just been discovered in Mongolia. Check that out. So, yeah, I have a bit of fun with the old Twitter. And the website, grahamparker.net, I'm very involved with that in as much as John does all the work, but I'm constantly doing input. And there's a box set out at the moment via that of me and the Rumor going back to the first days to a concert in St. Paul, Minnesota, doing, you know, promoting the Three Chords Good.
Oh.
So there's a box set of CDs on grahamparker.net.
All right. Well, we'll put links to all that.
Martin is handing it to me here.
Oh, beautiful. Can you hold it up?
That's well worth a look.
Hold up a little bit higher. There we go. All right, everybody can see that. We'll put a link up to that as well. Look at that.
Lots of incredible artwork on it, man. It's beautiful artwork. It's a little cartoonist. What's his name? Steve Lotter. And he used to work for Ren and Stimpy. That's how I met him. I was a big Ren and Stimpy fan.
Oh, nice.
That's the kind of artwork we're talking about. wild stuff, man.
Very
it's
nice.
Very good, and it's on grahamparker.net. Yeah, check
right.
that one out.
Well, Graham Parker, a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for all of your time. We've kept you a long time, but good luck with the documentary and the reunion tours and everything that's going on. Thanks so much for being with us on Mr. Media.
I appreciate it, Bob. Thanks. Be very well now. Take care.
Thank you, you too.
The preceding presentation was brought to you by The Realm Network.